From the earliest days of European settlement, the Wilmington area and the Cape Fear region have been places of active military involvement. From the American Revolution through the Civil War, from Liberty ships in World War II to the relocation of the battleship North Carolina, this area has seen its share and more of events that have shaped the military history of our country. In fact, there is right now a movement in progress to have Wilmington declared America's first World War II city. Our guest on today's Coastline is a man who knows a great deal about all these topics and more, Wilbur Jones. Wilbur is a military historian. Also, he is a captain in the U.S. Navy Reserve, retired. He's the immediate past chairman of the USS North Carolina Battleship Commission and chairman of the World War II Wilmington Homefront Heritage Commission. He's a retired civilian employee of the Defense Department and a former aide to Presidents Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. He has led battlefield tours in Europe, in the Asian Pacific area, and here in southeastern North Carolina. And he is one of the people spearheading, perhaps the person spearheading, the effort to have Wilmington declared America's first World War II city. Wilbur Jones, welcome to Coastline.
Thanks very much, Cleve. Glad to be here.
And we have a lot of things we can talk about today, and we'll let our listeners steer part of the conversation through their calls and emails. If you'd like to send us a question or comment, you can get in touch with us at coastline@whqr.org. That's our email address, or you can call us at 910-343-1138. And I guess some questions might be, are you a veteran? Did you live in Wilmington during World War II or grow up here? Did you work on one of the Liberty ships that were made here? Do you have any stories or questions about any aspect of the military history of this region or others? This is your chance to talk with an expert, Wilbur Jones, our guest on today's Coastline. So, Wilbur, let's start out with what I was just mentioning about the World War II city aspect of this. You've been involved, I think, with that, and I know this has been a years-long project in the making. What is the status of that now, and what's the genesis behind that?
For 8 years, I have been very heavily involved in an effort to seek national recognition for Wilmington as America's World War II city, based on what we did to contribute to the war effort during World War II, and subsequently what we have done since then to preserve that legacy. We have, in the last several years, gotten cooperation from our congressmen and our senators in introducing bills in the House of Representatives and the Senate that would call for that designation as the first American World War II city. Congressman McIntyre, who is now retired, and I explored all opportunities we could think of to have an organization designate us without a lot of unnecessary fanfare. And all of these years after World War II had been ended, no city had stepped forward to claim that title or even to seek it. But we found that even though organizations such as the Smithsonian and the National Trust for Historic Preservation felt that, gee whiz, Wilmington probably deserved it, but they didn't have the authority or responsibility to make that designation. So Congressman McIntyre said, let's go to the Congress. Let's introduce a bill, get it passed, have the president sign it. And that's a pretty good authority, responsible one. And so the evolution has come through three sessions of Congress now. Congressman Rauser, his bill was introduced last year. It's passed the House of Representatives as part of an omnibus or larger bill, Veterans Affairs. It is now over in the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee waiting for action. Senator Tillis last year introduced a companion bill in the Senate. It had been assigned to the Armed Services Committee and is still awaiting action there. So I'm in touch with the Senate offices of Senator Burr and Senator Tillis, who have been very cooperative in helping us And we're just trying to get it through the process over in the Senate. It's much different from the House, as you recognize. Mm-hmm. And their procedure.
You're talking about the bill as a whole. It's much different, not this particular little clause in it.
No, the bills are identical.
Oh, okay.
And we're not asking for money, and it's nonpartisan. And it's just a matter of them fitting it. It's just a one-page bill. And the question is, how is it fit into the process, the legislative process in the Senate? And I'm pulling my hair out right now. As I said, 8 years to going on nine. We're not giving up because Wilmington deserves this for what we did during the war and our efforts to preserve that history.
Well, let's talk about some of those efforts. A lot of people probably have seen, it's kind of a famous iconic portrait, I guess, a picture of Wilmington, an aerial portrait of Wilmington with a whole bunch of Liberty ships lined up along the river. And this was something that I didn't know about until I moved to Wilmington 6 years ago. But all the Liberty ships that were made here, over 240, I think, something like that, that were constructed here?
You're close, and I think what you're talking about is the reserve fleet after World War II.
Okay.
The mothball fleet was put up in the Brunswick River over in Brunswick County. And there were several hundred ships. Not all of them were made in Wilmington. During World War II, our shipyard produced 243 ships.
Okay.
About half of those were Liberty ships.
Uh-huh. Why was Wilmington selected for that? What made that – what was special about this? Did we already have that manufacturing and port capacity? I think, the shipbuilding yards all over the country. Why was Wilmington such an important
one? Oh, I'm sure it was political influence.
Really?
Probably. And we had the space. Uh-huh. Why not? They stayed there on the Brunswick River until well into the Vietnam War, when they were either activated for Vietnam service or scrapped or sold to other nations.
You mentioned that was one aspect of it, was the Liberty ships. What were some of the other aspects that would make Wilmington America's first World War II city?
Oh, gosh, how much time do we have? Just an hour?
Well,
a number of things. We were the headquarters for the Atlantic Coastline Railroad, which is one of the largest in the South. We had two Medal of Honor recipients from New Hanover High School, and Billy Halliburton and Charles Murray. To our knowledge, it's the only high school in the country with multiple Medal of Honor recipients from World War II.
Mm.
And we had a number of manufacturing plants here, like the Block Shirt Factory that made over a million shirts for the military. We had all five of the armed forces were stationed here. The Marines, of course, at Camp Lejeune, and boy, did they take over the town on Saturday night. And the Army was stationed here at Fort Fisher with an advanced training base, with their main base up at Camp Davis on Highway 17. The Navy was here with patrol boats hunting German submarines on the Cape Fear River and down in the Southport area. And the Army Air Forces was here. They took over what is now Wilmington International Airport, turned it into a submarine hunting base and a P-47 fighter base. And we had three German prisoner of war camps here.
You're listening to Coastline. Wilbur Jones is talking about the effort to declare Wilmington America's first World War II city. And I wanted to ask you specifically about that. You mentioned submarines, Wilbur. The rumor I've heard is that were there submarines definitely off the coast of North Carolina?
Oh, yes.
How close did they get?
Real close. They were sinking ships off of North Carolina, as you know. Wilmington was the southern end of what was called Torpedo Junction.
Uh-huh.
And several sinkings occurred off of the Southport, Wrightsville Beach area. And I can remember as a young boy walking on Wrightsville Beach and seeing the debris that would float up in the oil from the sunken ships that would reach the beach. And the submarine activity continued until about the middle of 1943, when the Battle of the Atlantic turned against the Germans.
And I I believe I heard you say, I was listening to some information that you gave to our producer, Isabel Shepherd, beforehand, that it's possible that that the only attack from a submarine on U.S. soil took place in this area.
Yes.
During World War II.
Yes, I believe that. My research indicates that it likely happened on the night of July 24th, 1943. A German submarine surfaced off of Curie Beach and fired three shots at the Ethel Dow chemical plant, which was on the Cape Fear River side of Federal Point. And they landed in the water and didn't fortunately hit the plant. If that happened, and I believe it did, I have interviewed witnesses, and there is a family at Curie Beach that claims that they have seen that the German submarine surface. It would be the only time that Germany actually attacked the east coast of the United States.
And I suppose we don't know which German submarine it was or what happened to the crew of that.
We believe we know because indications, post-war records indicated that we believe that submarine was sunk a couple of days later by aircraft from this area.
All right. Talking with Wilbur Jones here on today's Coastline. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a question for Wilbur, we have a lot of things to talk about today, not just World War II, but other kinds of things as well. If you have a question for Wilbur, please give us a call. Our phone number is 910-343-1138, and our email address is coastline@whqr.org. We'd love to have you as part of our conversation on this particular show. And we're going to come back. When you come back, there's another submarine question I want to ask you about that I've heard, and it's a rumor. Maybe you can tell us whether this rumor is true or if it has any credibility or if it's just a fanciful story that people like to tell around here. We'll find out about that. Our guest is Wilbur Jones. If you have a question about the Civil War, if you have a question about World War II, if you have a question about the history of this area or other areas, Wilbur has led tours of battlefields in Europe and in the Far East, and we'll find out about that also. You're listening to Coastline on WHQR. 910-343-1138 is the number, and our email address, coastline@whqr.org. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome to Coastline on WHQR. If you're in the mood for some chat about World War II, we're playing a little bit of Glenn Miller music here to get you in the mood because we're having a conversation about military history with military historian Wilbur Jones. Wilbur is a retired captain in the U.S. Navy Reserve and immediate past chairman of the USS North Carolina Battleship Commission, also chairman of the World War II Wilmington Homefront Heritage Commission. I'm Cleve Callison. I'm sitting in today for Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, encouraging you to be part of this conversation today. You can make a call to 910-343-1138, or you can make your comment or question online by writing to us at coastline@whqr.org. And Wilbur, we were talking about the issue of submarines. I've heard this rumor. Maybe you know this rumor. Maybe it's a true story that everybody knows, that there was the body of a German submariner washed up somewhere around here, and in his pocket was a ticket stub from a local movie theater. Is there any truth to that?
Sounds good, doesn't it?
It does.
Let's see. I guess you're probably the 200th person that we've had this conversation about. In fact, Ben Steelman of the Star News and I.
Well, that's probably where I saw it. Was in Ben Steelman's column.
Yeah. Well, we were emailing each other about that, and I think it is a myth. It is a very good story.
It's a good one.
But the important thing is that we do have evidence that German spies came ashore in the Carolina Beach, Curie Beach area. And they were apprehended, and we don't know what happened to them after that. But the business of having Bailey Theater tickets in the pocket is probably what urban legend? Is
that? Yeah, that's the right term.
But anyway, let's put that to rest.
Okay.
Move on.
All right, we'll move on. This is Coastline, and we encourage you to get in touch with us here. We do have a caller on the line. We'll get to her in just a second. Our phone number, 910-343-1138, talking with Wilbur Jones. And we're going to say hello to Ellen from Hampstead. Ellen, you're on the air. Welcome to Coastline.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I find anything about World War II very fascinating. My father was killed in 1943, February 3rd, and he was on the Dorchester. I know the history of the Dorchester, but I would just love to know if there are any survivors, anybody that was on that ship that are still alive today.
I can't answer that question universally. I have never run into anybody in Wilmington who was a survivor, but certainly for those who don't know the story of the Dorchester, that was the case where the Armed Forces chaplains gave their life jackets to members of the Armed Forces so they could save themselves. And
the story of the four chaplains. Yeah.
And the chaplains went down with the Dorchester. I would love to talk to you privately at your convenience about this story, because I've always felt that it was fascinating. And,
yes,
and please contact me.
Ellen, if you would, if you'll stay on the line, we'll get our producer, Claudia Thompson, to get your contact information so that so that you and Wilbur can get in touch with each other afterwards.
Okay. Thank you very much for taking a call. And the show is very, very interesting. Thank you.
Well, good. Thank you very much,
okay.
Ellen. I appreciate hearing from you. This is Coastline. Our guest is World War II historian Wilbur Jones. We're going to say hello now to – let me see if I can turn that one off. There we go. We're going to say hello now to Ray from this is Ray from Wilmington. Ray, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thanks, sir. Mr. Jones, I just would ask you to comment on two things. One, there was an enormous Army base at Holly Ridge that essentially vanished after the war. You know, enormous place up there with a lot of people were stationed.
Yeah, Camp Davis.
Yeah, and that's always intrigued me. And the other thing, if you got comments on the importance, I think one of the reasons subs may have laid offshore was the shipyard here. They put out a lot of ships. I think that was the biggest contribution we made to the war. They put ships out in record time down there at the shipyard. You got any notes on that or anything?
Oh, sure. To your first question, let's go to the second question first, and because we were talking about the number of ships that were built here, 243 altogether, and the submarines, it was like they were bait for the potential sinking, and it was not unlikely that many of them were chased after they finished their shakedown cruise and were commissioned and sent into service. And we even know that one of them was sunk not too far off the mouth of the Cape Fear River. And your first question?
I am not sure that he's still on the line.
About Camp Davis?
Yes, sir.
You know what happened to it? It was literally dismantled after the war. The Army closed the base down in 1944. It was an anti-aircraft artillery training base, and it had an advanced training base down at Fort Fisher. Some remnants of Fort Fisher World War II are still there, and they have a nice exhibit in the Fort Fisher Museum. But if you go to Camp Davis today, all you will see is just a metal pole marker, historic marker. There are a few signs there. In fact, the last time I drove through Camp Davis was just a couple of months ago, and there are some structures, foundations still there, maybe a building or two, and you can see the company streets, and the Marines have taken over from Camp Lejeune, have taken over the airstrip that was in use. But all the buildings were dismantled. They were sold. In fact, the chaplain, one of the chapels at Fort Fisher is now Greenfield Park, Greenfield Lake Baptist Church, right off of Greenfield in that area.
So it was moved from Camp Davis down there?
Yes, and they were sold for, you know, nickel and a dime because the military stayed there for a couple of years after the war until it was finally just decommissioned.
You're listening to Coastline on WHQR. Our guest is Wilbur Jones. I'm Cleve Callison sitting in today for Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Our phone number is 910-343-1138. And our email address is coastline@whqr.org. We're going to say now hello to Val Jean in Wilmington. Val Jean, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, I heard that there was a POW camp at the corner of 8th and Ann, and I was wondering if any of those prisoners stayed in the area or in the country after the war was over.
That's an excellent question. We had three prisoner of war camps here. As a matter of fact, the one you referred to between 8th and 10th on Ann Street and what is now Robert Strange Park, directly across from Williston Middle School, which during the war was the black high school, Williston Industrial High School. So that was the main camp. The first camp was at the corner of Shipyard Boulevard and Carolina Beach Road, right behind where the CVS drugstore is now. We have a historical marker there on that corner. And they were all German prisoners. They were captured in Tunisia in North Africa when General Rommel's Africa Corps surrendered in May of 1943. We got our share. They came here. We had about 550 Germans altogether at the maximum in that camp at Robert Strange Park. There was a third camp. It was a detachment that was out at Wilmington Army Air Base or Bleedenthal Field. And after the war, none of them stayed here, but several of them came back to Wilmington after the war, and a number of them stayed in touch with Wilmingtonians for whom they had worked because we had a labor shortage. And many of them were farmers, and they helped on the farms and the fertilizer factories in the area. And they stayed in touch with their Wilmington hosts.
That's fascinating to think about that that bond between people and something like that enduring even after the war, after the hostilities were over. That's an interesting story. You're listening to Coastline on WHQR. We're about halfway through this edition of the program, getting a lot of calls here, and we're going to take them just as quickly as we can, 910-343-1138. Our guest is Wilbur Jones. We're talking about military history with special reference to World War II in Wilmington. Let's say hello to Nancy from Wilmington. Nancy, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi. I know we're talking about World War II, but I'm just curious. I know next year will be the centennial of the U.S. entry into World War I, and I'm just wondering if you, your guest could speak to Wilmington's involvement in World War I and if there are going to be any events planned next year.
Yes, and thank you for thinking of the centennial of World War I. We've already started activities. As a matter of fact, a couple of years ago, we put together a public and government or private team and moved the county's, New Hanover County's only World War I memorial from in front of New Hanover High School down to the Riverwalk, right next to where the Coast Guard cutter Diligence docks, and I invite you to go down and see it. All these years, since early 1920s, that memorial had been at New Hanover High School, and no one even knew what it was. Nobody ever stopped to look at it, and so it was in connection with the centennial of World War I, we moved it down to the Riverwalk, where it's now very prominent. And go and visit. As far as other activities, working with Director Julie Wilsey of Wilmington ILM, we are going to update the displays in memorial to Arthur Bleedenthal, who was a Wilmington aviator for whom the airport eventually was named. He was the first Wilmingtonian killed during World War I. He was flying with the French Lafayette Flying Corps and was killed in 1918. And we're going to do something special to commemorate him.
Thanks very much for your call, Nancy. We appreciate hearing from you. You're listening to Coastline here on Public Radio, WHQR. Our guest is Wilbur Jones, military historian. Our phone number, 910-343-1138. And let's see, we're going to go to Bill from Wallace. Bill, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Just a follow-up comment on the Camp Davis and some of the chapels that got scattered about. I'm a Presbyterian minister and serve a Potts Memorial Presbyterian Church in Pinderley, North Carolina, that moved one of those chapels there. The chapel's pretty much in its same original condition. You can see a couple numbers on the wall where they moved it board by board. And they also moved, I believe it was a barracks that they used as their fellowship hall. And it's quite sort of a capsule of time, the way it's been preserved.
Have you ever been to that one, Wilbur, at Pinderley?
No, I haven't. But when I'm up there, I will stop in.
Okay.
They would love to have you.
All right. Bill, thanks very much for your call.
Sure.
You're listening to Coastline on WHQR. Let's get one more call coming in here. This is, let me make sure that I've got it going here. This is George from Wilmington. George, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you. My question is actually, I've been rereading The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, I think in part based to current circumstances, and I've been struck by some rather amazing similarities, and I was wondering if your guest would comment about our current political environment, our candidates, and how he thinks they do or do not seem to mirror some of the social and political situation that preceded World War II, and I'll take my answer off the line. Thanks.
Thanks very much. I don't know that either Wilbur or us is an authority on current political matters. I don't know that I want to touch that.
Let's stick to World War II and other things.
Yes. Thanks very much. All of these things are kind of in the eye of the beholder.
That's right. That was nice of him to call. I'm glad that he's reading that book because it's very informative, and certainly he will learn a lot from it. But I would prefer stick to World War II and military history.
You're listening to Coastline. Our guest today is Wilbur Jones, and we're talking with him about various aspects of military history, particularly World War II and the effort to make Wilmington a World War II city. Although there's a lot more we can talk about. But we did get a call. That caller is no longer on the line. This is Ann from Wilmington. And I believe this is the Ann Wilbur that you and I both know. And she was asking about the play that has been written. Margaret Rogers, is that the name? Something like that? Maybe we've got that name wrong. But there's a play that is being written about World War II and about Wilmington in World War II. And I know, Wilbur, you know about that. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay. Well, Margaret Rogers, dearly departed, was a wonderful friend of mine and was one of my cohorts in preserving history for a number of years. But this play, and I'm glad that Anne called in, this year is the 75th anniversary of the Hannah Block Historic USO Community Arts Center at 2nd and Orange Street, downtown Wilmington. It's also the 75th anniversary of the start of the USOs in the United States, but let me tell you what we're going to do. We have an original musical play titled Mrs. World War II Wilmington, We Fell in Love at the USO. It is written and will be produced by Tony Stimmick. Tony is a recent resident moved to Wilmington. He is a 40-year veteran of New York musical theater, writing, directing, producing. And his script is about soldiers from Camp Davis who meet local women and the things that go on during the war, and love triangles and so on, and with the ending taking place over in London as they are deployed and getting ready to go into the European battlefields. So we will have the opening night gala reception on Veterans Day, November the 11th, And then for that production, we'll have two productions on November the 12th and a matinee on November the 13th. So y'all mark your calendar and come on down to the USO for an original play.
So it will be at the USO.
Yes, it will. And there are a number of original scores that I've heard that are written for this play by New York songwriters. They're fantastic, and we're blending it in with some of the old favorites, contemporary songs such as In the Mood, Sentimental Journey.
Some of those today on our show. Yep. I want to get one more call in before we take a break. So we're going to go to Bob from Castle Hayne. Bob, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I went to the Hannon Block USO open house they had there two weekends ago. It was very interesting. First time I'd been there since it was redone. And I was notified about it by the article in the paper, Wilmington paper, the day before. And it had a picture of Villefranche-sur-Mer, France. And Wilbur, you had mentioned in it that I think you had been there. Were you based there in the military, or was this later visits?
Well, thank you. You got two of my favorite subjects in one there. That picture of Villefranche-sur-Mer on the French Riviera was a photo I took in a four-week trip to France in May. And after that, I wrote this piece for the Star News titled French Cuisine, Wines, and Culture about my experiences there. And I first went to France in 1958. I go there regularly. And the Star News thought, because I've written so many articles for them on military history and national defense, hey, why don't you write a low-tech primer for the average American traveler going to France? And I thought that would be tremendous. And we had a real good time, my traveling companion and I, and putting that together and writing the story.
Captain Jones?
Yes, Bob, make it quick.
Yes, I spent 22 months home based in that port in 1965 to 66 in the U.S. Navy. I was on the flagship of the 6th Fleet.
That's right. That was the home port of the 6th Fleet, Villefranche, for a long time.
Bob, thank you very much for your call. We're going to take a short break here, and then we'll come back for the final section of today's program. If you'd like to talk to Wilbur Jones, our phone number is 910-343-1138, or we can take your email questions at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline on your public radio station, HQR News 91.3. We'll be back. You're listening to Coastline on WHQR. Our topic today is military history. We're talking with military historian Wilbur Jones, and we've been talking primarily about World War II matters, which we can continue doing, but there's lots of other things we'll try to talk about in the final segment of today's program. So you've got about 15 minutes if you want to ask Wilbur a question or make a comment by calling 910-343-1138. And as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, Wilbur is captain in the U.S. Navy Reserve, retired, immediate past chairman of the USS North Carolina Battleship Commission, and chairman of the World War II Wilmington Homefront Heritage Commission. And he is actively working on trying to get the designation of Wilmington as America's first World War II city. And that's proceeding in Congress right now. A couple of things here. One caller called again. I guess they didn't hear what we were talking about earlier, referring to the rumor about a German submariner found on shore dead with a movie ticket in his pocket from a Wilmington theater. And I gather, Wilbur, you don't think that that's a credible thing, but it's a nice legend. Anyway.
Yes, it's fun to talk about.
Yeah, fun to talk about. That's good. And we also have an email. You can send an email to coastline@whqr.org. This is from Bill West, a fellow Forest Hills School alumnus, listening on the Internet from Oak Ridge, where he now lives up in the Triad area. He says, it's good to hear Wilbur, that you're still in the game. Thank you for your efforts to get Wilmington rightly recognized for World War II activities.
Bill West and I grew up together, and during World War II, we and other neighborhood kids, we fought all the battles on the home front here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, went through Forest Hills and New Hanover High School together. So, Bill, thanks for checking in, and we miss you down here. Sorry you had to move.
Well, let's talk about a couple of other things here, Wilbur, while we're waiting for some more callers at 910-343-1138. People who've been on Topsail Island see these structures, these concrete structures along there. Tell us about those. Those played a role in the war, did they not?
No, post-war.
No?
Mm-hmm.
Post-war.
Yeah.
Okay.
After the war, a couple of years after the war, the Navy began testing rocket propulsion and rocketry on Topsail Island and their missile program. And those towers, many of which are still there, were used for spotting and observation and other technicalities regarding the firing of rockets and missiles. In fact, their museum on Topsail Island is called Missiles and More Museum. And there's, if you're ever in that area, drop in, because it is probably it's the best museum to Camp Davis of World War II that's in existence.
Hmm. All right. Well, we'll recommend that to folks, and perhaps people can take advantage of that. But it's just a strange thing to drive along the coast there and see these big concrete bunker-type things on there. I wanted to ask you about something in a kind of different direction, Wilbur, knowing a little bit about your background, in addition to your work as a military historian, and I know you've led tours of various places, battlefields and things like that, but you also have had a career on the civilian side of things, and you were active in the White House under a couple of presidents. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I've had a wonderful career in staff politics, which began in Los Angeles, took me to Washington, D.C., and I spent 28 years in Washington, not all of which was in politics. But I had the pleasure of working my way up from being a precinct chairman in Los Angeles to working for two California Republican congressmen, one of whom was Barry Goldwater Jr., Senator Goldwater's son, who took me to Washington with him when he was elected. And I had a number of political staff positions in Washington and worked my way into the White House, where I served for 2 years as an advance representative and assistant to President Gerald Ford. And it was obviously the most remarkable part of my life and most remarkable and rewarding time that I have ever spent. President Ford was the best boss I ever had. He was everything you have heard about him being, a kind and congenial and very accommodating man with the responsibility he had. And it was also a 20-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week job.
Oh, I'm sure.
And
yeah.
And I was particularly brought home here over the July 4th weekend because I advanced his trip to New York City on July 4th of 1976, which was our nation's bicentennial.
Of course.
And
the tall ships in New York
Harbor. The tall ships, yeah. And the International Naval Review. And I had him on a Navy ship out in New York Harbor, and it began to rain. He disappeared. The Secret Service and I and his body man could not find him. Eventually, he showed up with the captain. He'd gone up to the captain's cabin, talked to the crew, had a cup of coffee, came back down. I said, "Mr. President, where have you been? We lost you." And he said, "No harm, Wilbur. I was up having a cup of coffee with the captain." And we were quite relieved because I became the only advance man in the Ford White House that ever lost the president. But it was raining like
crazy.
But at
least they found him again.
And listen, part of my job.
And the statute of limitations is probably expired.
That's right.
On that.
But I tell you, I could still feel the cold rain because it was cold. I was freezing on the Air Force One coming home back to Washington, D.C., because I have to hold the umbrella over the president. He stays dry and I get wet.
No. Well, let's take a couple more calls from World War II, about World War II from our listeners. Our guest is Wilbur Jones. I'm Cleve Callison, your host for Coastline. 910-343-1138 or coastline@whqr.org. Let's say hello to Rusty from Oak Island. Rusty, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm 69 and born and raised my early years in Wilmington. Third and Dawson area when Dawson was a two-way street. And I remember as a child putting up their houses, my dad, my uncle, had to search the houses, look under the beds, the closets for German and Japanese. They winked as me as a child to come join them. But before my aunt, my mom, and grandmother could go in, we had to clear the premises. So where did that fear come from? There was Wilmington that, you know, that at risk or what?
Rusty, you're talking about something that happened after the war or during the war?
Yeah. I was born just at the end of the war, about 69. And that may have been a family.
Yeah, so that fear persisted long after the war was over then.
We had green shades hanging from the window, kind of a, you know, throwback to blackouts and things like that, I think, that Wilmington experienced. I'm just wondering if it was founded or, you know, what's the reason? Was it my family needing help then, or was it a great fear that gripped this city?
Well, during World War II, there was a fear for the first 2 years of the war that we could be attacked any time. And I have very vivid memories of blackouts and having to pull shades down and street lights that were painted black on the top and air raid sirens going off and airplanes going out to attack submarines that may or may not be there. Yes, there was that fear because the government let us know that the possibility of attack. And from 1944 on, it started to wane, and then as the war turned in our favor. But post-war, I don't remember that in post-war because after the war ended, I mean, we were back to as normal as we could be.
Rusty, thank you for your call. You know, that does bring to mind the fact that we're probably much more aware of this today. There's been a lot more publicity about the effects of now what we call PTSD, and in World War I, I think they called it shell shock. I'm not sure what they called it in World War II, but there certainly were some people who had psychological effects long after the war was over, whether they were in combat or not, just the great, great fear that came about. We had a comment here at Coastline. The listener is no longer on the line, but Darcel from Leland called in with a comment, and she wanted to talk about the fact that there's a lot of talk about the greatest generation, referring to the people who fought World War II, the Americans who went to war, either willingly or being drafted, and wanted to hear a discussion about why aren't African Americans mentioned specifically. And I guess Truman desegregated the military after World War II, and maybe in 1948 or something like that, according to Darcel. But there certainly were African-American soldiers who were part of the war effort, were there not?
Oh, yes. And here
the Tuskegee Airmen
Tuskegee Airmen, I've studied extensively, and the service that they provided as fighter pilots over in the European campaign. During World War II, the services were segregated, and the African-Americans were utilized primarily in the rear echelon areas as cargo handlers and stevedores and in clerical jobs. There were a couple of divisions, all-black divisions, infantry divisions, and tank battalions that did see service. But the Tuskegee Airmen were the more famous ones. Here in Wilmington, we had Camp Davis soldiers. Many of them were black, and they had their own club, which is was at 9th and Nixon Street, which now is the Community Boys and Girls Club. It's the building itself is very similar to the Hannah Block Historic USO at 2nd and Orange Street. But one thing I remembered so much, and in doing my research for my books, was that the best clubs in town were the black clubs. The black clubs attracted the Duke Ellington and Ella Fitzgerald and Cab Calloway and that type of entertainment. And they wouldn't come to the white clubs. Hmm. And they didn't play Lumina. And the clubs were segregated as well. But it was a whole different time then.
Mm-hmm. But it's important to recognize that contribution.
Yes.
So, Darcell, thank you very much for that call. It's very important. You're listening to Coastline. We've got about, 5 minutes or so left for your call. So hurry up if you want to get on the air. 910-343-1138 is the number. And our email address is coastline@whqr.org. You lead tours of battlefields. I mentioned that you, I think you've led tours in Europe, in France, and other places like that. But you also lead tours around this area, I believe.
Yes, I do.
Historic sites. What are some of the places that you go on those tours?
Well, in the Pacific, I've taken them to a lot of the Pacific battlefields. But most of my attention in recent years has been in Europe. Battle of the Bulge, Normandy, D-Day, the invasion of southern France, Operation Market Garden in the Netherlands, and so on. But locally, I do lead tours for about a 3.5-hour tour of the World War II sites here. We go to Fort Fisher and see the base there. We go see the prisoner of war camps. We go over to the shipyard, which is still important because many of the buildings that were built for the shipyard are still in use by the State Ports Authority. And we go to New Hanover High School to see the memorial to our two Medal of Honor recipients and take them to a number of places like that. And if anyone is interested in a tour like that, contact me.
Yeah, give us a call here at the station, 910-343-1138. I wanted to mention, I don't think she's on the line, but Nicole from Wilmington, who is a social worker dealing with mental health issues, we talked about the fact of PTSD. She said in World War II, it was sometimes called combat fatigue or soldier's heart. Those are not terms that I'm familiar with.
Combat fatigue was the accepted term.
Okay. Very good. Let's go to Bob from Wilmington with a question. Bob, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hello. I heard you mention the shipyard. That was sort of my comment. It just, what did you know? I guess they built the most amount of Liberty ships in World War II, or a high amount here, and just that relationship and the houses and Sunset Park and the effect it had on the area. I'll hang up and listen to your comment.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks for that added dimension of the shipyard impact, particularly the housing that the so-called temporary housing that went up to house the workers. Many of those developments are still in use today.
Yeah, he mentioned Sunset Park.
Sunset Park was part of the community, but he's probably thinking about Maffitt Village and the Greenfield Lake areas. And also Hillcrest at Dawson and 15th, which are still in use today. They were built for black shipyard workers and non-commissioned officers.
Okay. We don't have a lot of time left, so I want to mention a couple of things. Clarification, I'd mentioned earlier, a soldier's heart. That apparently, I'm told by our producer, Claudia, is a term from the Civil War era, soldier's heart. And also, let's see if we can get to Jana from Wilmington. Jana, very quickly, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question has to do with the women Air Force service pilots who were stationed at Camp Davis during the
during World War II.
Okay. Wilbur, any comments about that quickly?
Camp Davis was the first duty station for the WAS after they finished their training at Sweetwater, Texas. And they were flying targets, pulling targets for anti-aircraft purposes for training.
That'll have to do it for this edition of Coastline. We thank you very much for joining us today. Our guest has been Wilbur Jones, a local military historian. Wilbur, thank you so much for being here with us. And we'd like to invite you to join us next time, this time next week for Coastline with your regular host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Our producer is Isabel Shepherd. Thank you, Isabel, for great work and prep for this show. And our phone screener today was Claudia Thompson. Thank you, Claudia. Ken Campbell was our audio engineer. I'm Cleve Callison, executive producer. Thank you for listening to this broadcast of Coastline.